This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll look into the other Legislative Gazette. Also, a battle is brewing over taxing books, and the legislature may be asked to modify the seatbelt law to make it tougher. In one sense, Albany is a permanent battleground. Take, for example, taxes. Sometimes these battles erupt into full-scale wars, but most often they are fought out of public view by people who are largely anonymous. Recently, however, a new tax fight has been joined, and it promises to be very public. Not just because the New York Times, the Washington Post, and several other publications have written about it, but because some of the foot soldiers are people like Norman Mailer and William Kennedy. While Kennedy is a quiet man, has Norman Mailer ever failed to make headlines? The issue is whether the state of New York and New York City should repeal the sales tax currently levied on books. A group called Don't Tax Knowledge has been formed to lead that fight, and Bill Gralty spoke with Parker Ladd about it.
Books are taxed in New York State and New York City, correct?
That's correct. In both state and city, there's a 4.25% sales tax and a 4% city tax.
And how about other outlets of knowledge, if you will, magazines
and
newspapers?
Well, newspapers and magazines are excluded from the sales tax in both areas, which seems inequitable, certainly that the books bring the same kind of editorial content and erudition that magazines and newspapers do.
Has this system been in effect for a while? Has the tax been on for a long time?
The tax has been on the books since the implementation of the sales tax in New York State.
Why the decision now to sort of mount a campaign of this type?
Well, I think it was a part of inertia that no one, at the time when newspapers and magazines sought relief from this and developed a lobby in Albany, they were successful, and the book publishers didn't make any effort at that time. And now there's an energetic young group of publishers that see the enormous problem, and we see that people are not buying as many books as they used to because of this, and we find that most disconcerting, that book readers feel the restriction of books because of this increased tax. We have documented evidence from booksellers that people come in, pick up two $4.95 paperback books and go up to the trade paperback books, you know, on some area of knowledge, and they take it up to the cash register, and it's rung up to be way over 10, and they said, oh, my budget was 10, and they put one back. And the same thing happens with a hardback book. Say, well, I'm going to spend $30 on books this month, and take two hardback books up, it's $14.95, and they get up there, and it's up over $16, and they put one back. Up over $30, excuse me, not $16.
And this, the feeling is this happens quite a bit?
Yes. We also feel that there's a subliminal attitude that if something is taxed, therefore it's a luxury and not a basic part of one's way of life, and that also restricts the open approach to books.
Obviously, you don't feel that books are a luxury, but rather a necessity.
Absolutely. They're the food for the soul and the intellect.
Now, some are going to argue, I would suppose, that some books certainly would fit into that category and some books might not. Is there any way to differentiate, or is this just all books should not be taxed?
I think in the spirit of the First Amendment, it is important, but that all books not be taxed. And we also know from studies, I mean, if we're talking about salacious materials or incidental materials, but also anyone who reads, no matter whether they're another group may say, well, that's trash and not worth reading, that's for each individual to seek his own level of reading compatibility. But we do know that as people read more and more, they change and they become more sophisticated in their tastes, and they seek varied levels of information, learning, and entertainment. And so that it would not be in the helpful in the spirit of what we are attempting to do, to say, well, there'll be tax on romances, because that reader who cuts their teeth on reading romances develops into being a more sophisticated reader in many, many instances as time goes on.
What kind of support do the publishers have in this effort?
We seem to have unilateral support throughout the book community, from the library associations, from private citizens, from authors such as Norman Mailer and Jonathan Kozol and Erica John and Toni Morrison and William Kennedy, John Irving, and the bookselling community and publishers, intellectuals, lay readers.
And who's the opposition, if I might ask?
We have not discerned any opposition at the moment. Perhaps the fiduciary people who would feel that this was an economic loss to the state budget. In reality, it's a very small loss in terms of the overall New York State and New York City tax budget.
Parker Ladd is with the Don't Tax Knowledge Group. Despite his protestations, you can bet there will be some opposition, and we'll be following it for you. One of last year's great public controversies was the seatbelt bill. It is, of course, now the law of the land, but the legislature may be asked to make the law even tougher. Bill Gralty has that story.
New York's law, as state-sponsored educational campaigns have made abundantly clear to the public, requires the driver and front seat passenger to be strapped in. It also continues the traditional requirement that children ride in approved safety seats. And since its inception at the start of the year, it has resulted in a marked increase in seatbelt use. But the Coalition for Safety Belt Use is continuing a drive to get more people buckled in. And the coalition is advocating making the law even tougher. Executive Director Elaine Petroselli.
We would like to see that rear seat occupants be required to buckle up as well, because we know that from experience in other countries that unrestrained rear seat occupants can seriously injure front seat occupants, even when those front seat occupants are belted in. So we would like to see everybody in the car appropriately restrained.
Is there going to be a push for that kind of legislation?
As far as the coalition is concerned, yes. We will make our influence felt as much as we can during the next legislative session, yes.
Elaine Petroselli is Executive Director of the Coalition for Safety Belt Use. In Albany, I'm Bill Gralty.
Now let's hear from regular contributor Jerry Benjamin, a political scientist and Republican County legislator from Ulster County.
The company the governor keeps. It's often said that a man is known by the company he keeps. Though not always true, of course, this aphorism is more likely to apply to governors than to others, if only because they, more than others, can control with whom they spend their time. And in case you haven't noticed, the company Mario Cuomo is keeping lately has changed quite substantially since he first took office 2.5 years ago. The replacement in late July of the governor's secretary, Michael Del Judice, by his counsel, Gerald Crotty, and the appointment of Evan A. Davis to replace Crotty in the council's job were only the two most recent changes in peak staff positions in the Cuomo administration. Crotty had earlier replaced Alice Daniel, Cuomo's original appointee as counsel. Shortly thereafter, Mike Finnerty left as budget director to take a job at Yale University, and Tim Russert, the director of communications recruited from Senator Pat Moynihan's staff in Washington, departed for a position in the media. In fact, precious few top staff jobs in the executive chamber in Albany are filled with the original appointees to them. Even the governor's son, Andrew, is working elsewhere. Is this amount of turnover normal? The governor thinks so. I'm sure this kind of thing will occur over and over again, Cuomo said in a recent interview. A lot of people who are into government work have to leave to earn the wealth to support families. But though their salaries are not excessive for the level of responsibility they are given, Crotty's as secretary will be $85,000 a year. Top gubernatorial aides are not exactly earning hardship wages. Moreover, they may be leaving for better opportunities, but they are leaving sooner than their predecessors and with seemingly fewer incentives to depart. During the Kerry administration's first term, there was a level of turnover comparable to that under Cuomo, but it occurred later. Kerry's aides were leaving a governor entering his final year in office who seemed headed for certain defeat in 1978 and who lacked serious presidential prospects. In contrast, top staff are leaving Cuomo during a time in which the governor is being widely discussed as a presidential contender and seems so strong a prospect for re-election that state Republicans are having a hard time finding a viable opponent for him. Going back further, a comparison with the Rockefeller administration reveals that rapid change in top gubernatorial staff jobs is not necessarily the norm. William Ronan, Rockefeller's first secretary, served well into the governor's second term before going on to head the MTA. At Budget, T. Norman Hurd was director for 12 years and then became director of state operations and secretary to the governor. Only in the council's office under Rockefeller was top staff turnover as rapid as in successor administrations. Certainly, there is no evidence that Mario Cuomo was harder on staff than was Hugh Carey or Nelson Rockefeller. And those who left him, Russert and Del Judice, for example, expressed an interest in keeping their hand in for a presidential bid. Rockefeller, we should remember too, could offer special incentives to overcome the gap between public and private sector salaries, as he did with William Ronan. Nevertheless, the current rate of turnover in top executive chamber posts, despite all the attractions of position and power, is troubling. In addition to the discontinuities in policymaking and administration that may result as people leave, there is the example set for those on lower rungs in state service. That example, despite all the top-level talk about encouraging public service careers, is this: if you can, take the money and run.
Gerald Benjamin. In Albany, there are two legislative gazettes, the newspaper and the program you're listening to now. Glenn Doty is the editor of the Legislative Gazette newspaper, which we think is one of the more unique educational undertakings around the New York State Capitol. This year, for the first time, the Legislative Gazette becomes a full-time undertaking. I took the occasion to reminisce with my old friend and colleague Glenn about old times. Glenn, what are your earliest memories of how the Legislative Gazette got started?
My earliest memories are of you scrambling to maintain the berth, I suppose. That's the first memory I have, because as I remember it, I walked into your office and we sat down, and before the morning was over, we were getting phone calls that the Gazette was dead. And before the afternoon was over, it was breathing again. And lo and behold, we kind of operated out of our hip pocket that first year and out of some pretty small office space, and with students sitting on the floor typing on top of typewriter cases. But it was tough times.
Well, you ran a major metropolitan paper, the Middletown Record, Herald Record. How would you compare what we started with in the way of resources to a major newspaper?
Oh, my God. A daily newspaper editor, let's say, of the size of 20,000 circulation, would look at what we did and say it can't be done. It couldn't possibly be done. In fact, I can think, for instance, of a 5,000 circulation daily down in my area, the Tri-States Gazette, and I would bet that the editor of that paper, seeing what we did, or seeing what we had to work with the first year, would say, no, you can't publish a paper. It can't be done.
Now, we really had no real right to start that paper in terms of the planning process, wouldn't you say?
You had it all mapped out. You knew what. You conceptualized. You knew what the potential was. And you felt that you had students at DuPont, and it was one of those things where you and I kind of came together by accident.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a marriage right off the bat, I guess, and it's been a pretty good one. But Glenn,
if Brown University or somebody like that were doing it, they'd get out there and they do all kinds of feasibility studies and they get all kinds of grants to start this kind of.
Out the first 5 years' papers on what they'd spent on feasibility.
You supervise, of course, all the reporters and look at their work. What was your sense of how much they knew, that first group, when they showed up about state government?
You probably could put it on the head of a pin. It still had room for the Constitution.
So
they really didn't know very much. I'll tell you one thing. They were a bright group. And they had a lot of potential, and they sure did live up to their potential.
How many of them were there?
Oh, God, I think there were six.
And how many were there in the biggest year that the Legislative Gazette has had?
We've had 32 or 3, I guess.
33. So there's really no other paper that has 33 reporters working exclusively on state government. Is that right?
No. In that regard, we're far and away the largest Capitol Bureau probably in the world.
Glenn, is there less resistance now than there was previously in the beginning? Was there much resistance, and what's happened since that time?
Well, you know, initially the folks felt they could operate with certain few people, you know, but it was a very limited number, and I think a lot of people were nervous about the operation of the program because they said to themselves, wow, you know, here we are, we're sitting up here, we're, you know, writing law every day. And here are these young people, and they aren't full-fledged reporters, and boy, they may screw things up terribly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's been your job and mine to make sure they don't do that. And if anything, if there's going to be an error, let's be wrong on the conservative side. That is, you know, let's be very, very, very sure that we know what we're talking about, rather than think we know what we're talking about.
Well, one of the things that's always amazed me about you, Glenn, is that you, of course, don't know everything, and yet you've kept the newspaper out of a lot of trouble. So you get a piece of copy from one of the students, and a little red light, it seems to me, goes off in your head saying, I don't think this is right. Now, how does that work?
Well, I don't know. I suppose it's, I spent a lot of years on a copy desk, sports, news, you know, and I don't know. I suppose it's just one of those things that you've got a gut reaction, and you know, somehow or another, you're reading something, and it just doesn't feel right. It just, or for instance, you know that Clarence Rampillet is going to say something about this, and you know, because Clarence Rampillet has certain points of view, that it doesn't have a ring of truth. Now, it may be that Rampillet said something like that, but that wasn't what he meant. And you know, you say to yourself, you just know certain things. You know, for instance, that Stanley Fink is not going to stand up in a lecture and say, let's raise taxes 100%. I mean, you know that. And if somebody comes in and says, boy, the speaker just said we got to raise taxes at least 100% to do this, you know that somehow or another, he didn't say, we're going to cross the board, raise everybody's income tax 100%.
Mm-hmm. So you say to the student as nicely as you can, go out and find out some more.
Yeah, because that just doesn't... I don't think the speaker intends to do that. I mean, he wants to be speaker next year. He doesn't want to be the former speaker.
Do they ever get real mad at you, the reporters, Glenn, in terms of he's really busting my chops?
Oh, yeah. They get very angry. In fact, the funny thing is, I had one student just last semester who said to me, you shouldn't have told me, you shouldn't have told me that I was doing so badly because that frightened me and it took me a long time to get back on track. And so I said to her, listen, if I didn't tell you you were doing badly and just let you go, that would be bad management. Not only would that be bad management, that would be bad teaching.
Do you think there are too many teachers who do that today? In other words, just know it's easier not to tell a student that they have to behave in a particular kind of way and just...
I don't know about that. All I know is that up here, they have to know that there's a right way and done is the wrong way, and I always want them to do it the right way. Now, the curious thing is, the student who was somewhat miffed at me wrote me a letter. I got it just the other day,
mm-hmm.
and said, thank God, I came to the Gazette. And, you know, everything you told me, I mean, this particular young woman has been working since graduation at a daily newspaper in Westchester County. And she said to me, thank God, you know, you pressed and made me do this and made me do that, because I'm prepared. I'm prepared, and I'm doing okay. I'm still nervous, but I'm doing okay.
And that, of course, is contrasted with some of these journalism schools, Glenn, it seems to me, which mock up newspapers but don't distribute them. At least these students have the responsibility to look at what they have written has caused or reaped out there in the field. They're going to get reaction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, here they sit in the lap of government, and they go off to, you know, a daily newspaper or a weekly newspaper somewhere, and they've already experienced, they've already seen what can happen if a middle initial is left out or is wrong or a name is misspelled. Because one of the things we know is that people never forget when their name is misspelled.
Okay, so Glenn, one of the things that I find fairly interesting in all of this is that when I speak to people who read the Legislative Gazette, almost never do they know now that these are students who are putting out the newspaper as journalism students, as opposed to adult reporters. They always act as if they're in shock these days. Now, in the old days, we used to make it very clear in the paper that they were students. We don't do that anymore. Is it your sense that we've arrived at this almost consciously, or has this just happened?
Well, I think that, you know, with acceptance, with the growth of the program, I think even perhaps with the overall journalism program at New Paltz perhaps being more sophisticated, with you know, input from students at SUNY Albany, or for instance SUNY Stony Brook, as we have this year, with some of the independent colleges like St. Bonaventure. Okay, I think that I think the level of sophistication is greater. I think that it's reflected in what they do, the kinds of questions they can ask. Doesn't mean they still aren't going to start out asking the same dumb questions. You know, you have to, I guess you have to stub your toe once or twice to remember to, you know, pick up your feet. And I just think that each year, somehow or another, we seem to be a little more sophisticated. Maybe I challenge them a little bit more. Maybe I have more and more confidence in what they can do. Maybe that's part of it. I just don't know. But I do know that anymore, you're right, it's amazing, and people are flabbergasted when they discover that this is a student publication. Now, Norman Adler said, my God, I, you know, sometimes I kind of wish they'd ask more of the tough questions, or they'd go in and they'd do some sort of an in-depth piece, perhaps interpreting what happened. But, you know, that's the kind of thing, in my view, that has to be left to the more seasoned reporter. Now, maybe we'll get a person here in another year who will have that kind of insight and who can jump right off and do something like that. But, you know, I don't know. I think that I certainly do think that I was nervous at one point, and you'll remember this, when, you know, you said to me, why don't we try running my column, you know, the one you do for the dailies throughout the state. And I was a little nervous about that because I thought, well, what the heck, it's a student newspaper. But, you know, the more I've looked at it, thought about it, I think it's added dimension. I think it's added, given us a little more depth. I think, if anything, that in and of itself may have added to the credibility. It may have added to the professionalism. You
know? How about the advertising that we do now, that we take advertising?
I don't think there's any question about that. I think one of the things we know is, for instance, we know that the advertising gave us credibility in many respects. People said, well, if people are willing to pay money to be in that newspaper, and it must be worthwhile.
Last question. Are you proud of what we've done?
Sensational. Proud. Oh, my God. Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I look at you and I say to myself, you must be 7'11", because, wow, that was a hell of an idea. Pardon the But it was. It was an outstanding idea, and it was something. It was something that you said at the time is needed here. And I was happy. I thought, wow, this is really an opportunity to work with a group of young people. But, you know, I think it is needed. And so many legislators come back and say, gosh, thank God for the Gazette. You know, we really have a chance to keep up. We know what's going on. And you know, in many ways, it gives them an opportunity to say to their colleagues what's on their mind.
Glenn Doty. For some years now, I have been astounded when people who regularly hear the Legislative Gazette on the radio tell me they have just discovered there's also a newspaper of the same name. Of course, there are also people who read the newspaper who don't know that there's a radio show that enjoys the same nomenclature. So to clarify the situation, let me recount a little history. The Legislative Gazette newspaper came first, but not by much. Faithful WAMC listeners who have tuned into this program over the years will realize that the show has gone through a rather substantial metamorphosis since those days when Legislative Gazette reporters from the newspaper sat around a big table in the old studio on Madison Avenue and reported on their state beats, much in the same way that Washington Week in Review works on television. Then when news director Stephen Medaris took over as the director, he decided that WAMC news personnel would be featured on the program. In the beginning, it was Glenn Doty, the same Glenn Doty you just heard, who did the commentary, which is now done by a host of others, like Fred Dicker of the New York Post, Professor Jerry Benjamin, and the outstanding Marist College professor and pollster Dr. Lee Merengoff. Of course, students of WAMC history will remember that Bryn Quell would also do frequent reports on the Legislative Gazette in the early days. And like all popular series, the Legislative Gazette also had an important spin-off in the form of the Capital Connection radio show with Governor Mario Cuomo. One day while interviewing the governor for this show, I asked him whether he'd consent to do a regular show on public radio, and that's how all that got started. By now, our radio archives have feature interviews with just about everybody in state government. Some of those interviews have made important news featured in the daily press. Others were just generally interesting. Some were not. But the Legislative Gazette newspaper was the nut from which this radio show sprang and itself was the parent of the Capital Connection. We hear a lot about both Legislative Gazettes these days. When decision makers want to talk to each other in state government, they sometimes choose to use these vehicles. And Glenn Doty and the State University at New Paltz are to be congratulated because the Legislative Gazette newspaper continues to grow. And for the first time this fall, the newspaper will be published in the fall semester. And we like to think that the newspaper, which will be concentrating in large part on the agencies of government, will make as much of a difference in an open government as it has when it only published from January to the end of the legislative session. We hope you'll all continue to tune in for this program and to read the Legislative Gazette. If you want to know how, write me at the station. That's our show for this week. Join us again next week for another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty edits and produces this program. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC Box 13000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.